United States to seek asylum. This case that I reported on in my story for The Nation suggests that parents who get their asylum claim denied, which is very likely to happen with new limits that Sessions has implemented here, they may have to decide, am I going to go back to the country that I fled with my child, or am I going to leave my child in the United States to face a separate asylum claim? They have additional opportunities that they could pursue. But these are parents whose children think they abandoned them. We've heard reports that the children can't even remember what their parents look like. And now, once that parent's reunited, if they're able to be reunited, they're going to have to face a second separation.
We're going to continue to follow this next week. Thank you very much, Democracy Now!'s Renee Feltz. We'll link to your piece at The Nation. That does it for this broadcast. Happy birthday to Karl Marxer. Democracy Now! Produced by an amazing group of people. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Join WHFR this weekend as we broadcast from the 26th Annual Concert of Colors. Concert of Colors is a festival showcasing world music, and WHFR will be down there at the Max M. and Marjorie S. Fisher Music Center on Woodward to help support the great music. WHFR will be right outside the Comerica Diversity Stage and broadcasting from the Cube July 14th and 15th, so stop by and see some of your favorite WHFR DJs. We can tell you where to find everything at Concert of Colors and hear what is coming up on your favorite listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
Once upon a time, there was a nice house that lived with a family. The house loved the family and took care of them. One day, it started to rain and rain. The house wanted to protect the family, but the water got inside and ruined everybody's everythings. The house was so sad, but the family didn't think it could happen. They told the house that they would take better care of her, always.
Protect what matters. Learn more about your flood risk at floodsmart.gov/care.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener supported, non-commercial radio.
It's WHFR 89.3, also online at WHFR.FM, making waves. I'm Alan Mazurek. Susan McGraw and I are continuing our little summer vacation here from the new WHFR Journal so that we can bring you another very fascinating series of programs that we have found. This one deals with education in America. It's called Degrees of Separation, and it's going to run for the next few weeks in place of the new WHFR our journal. Don't worry, we will be back in due time with a fresh take on the new WHFR journal. We do hope you'll stick around and enjoy this program. It's a part of our public service to you, our listeners, as we look at education in America on the program Degrees of Separation here on WHFR. We're always making waves.
From the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, this is With Good Reason. Historically black colleges and universities often struggle for financial support and respect.
It's the way that we think. We tend to think things that are black are not as good, and we continue to think that. That's how American racism works.
And research shows college affordability is a greater problem for students of color.
Students of color have historically been barred from entering post-secondary institutions. Now that they have access on unequal terms.
Plus, mounting evidence that for-profit colleges aren't worth the cost.
For-profit colleges are definitely costing a lot more for students, and they are giving them less. Their earnings gains are a lot lower than going to a public institution.
All this and more today on With Good Reason. First, the news.
Camp Henry offers hands-on learning activities in science, technology, engineering, arts, and math to help kids and teens with an early start in these high-demand career paths. The Henry Ford College Telecommunication Program and WHFR will show campers how their favorite actors, cartoon voices, newscasters, and DJs work their magic to bring us the entertainment we love. Registration is now open for the media camp, which runs from July 23rd through the 26th, so go to hscc.edu and click on Camp Henry for more details and for more information about the exciting programs Camp Henry has to offer.
Green jobs are here to stay. Why not go green with a degree in alternative energy here at Henry Ford College? Students will acquire knowledge in advanced fuel sources and the practice of alternative energy in the world. For more information on the alternative energy program, please contact HFC's Technology Division by calling 313-317-9816 or by going to hfcc.edu/programs.
Last year, affirmative action made headlines again when the Supreme Court heard the case of Abigail Fisher.
Like most Americans, I don't believe that students should be treated differently based on their race. Hopefully, this case will end racial classifications and preferences in admissions at the University of Texas. Thank you.
Fisher, who's white, was denied entrance to the University of Texas when she found out she blamed affirmative action for her rejection. The Supreme Court ruled against her, but the debate about affirmative action in America's universities continues. I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on With Good Reason, we bring you Degrees of Separation, the fourth in our special series on education and inequality. Affirmative action opens the doors to America's most elite colleges and universities to students of all backgrounds. But the way these institutions justify affirmative action can be problematic in and of itself. Natasha Waraku is an associate professor of education at Harvard University, and she says we need to rethink what we want from college admissions. Natasha, college is supposed to be a meritocracy, is it?
So I think in some ways it is. You know, colleges spend a lot of time and resources in selecting students. I should say selective colleges do. So, you know, they look at obviously SAT scores, grade point averages, but also, you know, take a holistic view, read teacher recommendations. They look at what students have been doing outside of school time. So they do take a lot of information in and make assessments. And in that sense, we might say that it's a meritocracy. On the other hand, we know that the outcomes that selection processes produce are unequal, right? So, for example, we know that Black students, Latino students, working class students, students whose parents didn't go to college are much less likely to be selected on the other end of these processes than students who are growing up with advantage.
Could we make the admissions process fairer, in your estimation?
You know, part of the answer to this question really depends on how we define what meritocracy is and what it really means, right? Some people think that fair is you select all the people with the highest SAT score. Some people think that, you know, a fair system of selection would select the most well-rounded students. And so, again, I think how we need a kind of collective understanding of what fairness would really be. And we could do that and say, well, you know, what are the goals of a university? If the university's goal is to, for example, produce the leaders of tomorrow, then how do we select people that we know are most likely to be leaders? And what are the qualities of leadership? If we want to select students, for example, in ways that contribute to a robust civic society or democracy, then we need to think about how we select students to make sure that they have those capacities. Fairness depends on how we define what fair is, and what fair is really depends on, well, what are the goals of our university? What are we trying to do here?
When you drilled down a little bit for your book and looking at what the American college student said about the values of diversity, did you find that they saw diversity was important for the whole or for the individual?
Yeah, so they very much said that, especially the white students in particular, said that diversity is important because it contributes to something I call the collective merit of the cohort. So students talked often in admissions that a fair system is one that selects students that can contribute to this really rich learning environment. So, you know, you want to have some musicians who can play for the orchestra. You want to have athletes who can man the sports teams. You want to have that chemist who's going to do groundbreaking research in the chemistry department. And race is part of that. You need a quorum of, in particular, Black and Latino students, because they have perspectives to offer their peers. And I think they're right. And there's a lot of research that shows that racially diverse campuses have a lot of positive impact on everything from racial attitudes to civic participation down the line, cognitive capacity. But the problem is that it sort of ignores the benefits to those individuals, right? So we might also think about considering race because there is and has been historically racial inequality in American society that has affected specific groups, and that because of that, this is a kind of compensatory policy, right, that says that there is racial inequality, so we need to take that into account when we make these admissions decisions. Students are saying no, that race is important because we need a diverse cohort on campus. That's part of what it is to have a good college experience.
What's wrong with that? I mean, that seems like,
yeah,
that seems,
yeah,
like the broadest, most uplifting version of why we need diversity.
Yes, and absolutely. And in many ways, it is very positive, right? Because it recognizes the value that people of color bring to these environments. What I noticed is that this rationale, when that is the only reason that you support race-based policies, it has these kind of strange knock-on effects. White students are expecting their minority peers to integrate into white spaces. Because if those minority peers are there to provide their perspective on campus, well, then it's perplexing when, you know, they see a table of Black students sitting together in the cafeteria, or their Latino roommate joins the Latino Students Association, because what they understand is those students benefit from affirmative action in order to be on campus, but they can't benefit from those perspectives if the students of color are in their own spaces. You know, there's a lack of recognition of why those organizations might be incredibly important for some students of color, and there's this expectation that those students of color integrate. They also have this idea that you need a certain kind of experience in order to benefit from affirmative action. So Black and Latino students on campus are all assumed to have benefited from affirmative action. And so, you know, students will say things like, well, I know someone who had a very, quote unquote, white experience, and they shouldn't benefit from those race-based policies because they're not adding anything to the cultural fabric of campus. And so there's this idea that, you know, often there's an assumption that, well, if you are a beneficiary, you have to have a particular kind of life experience that's labeled Black or Latino, often associated with poverty.
And associated with hardship. If you went to the School of Hard Knocks, then you're a valuable person to have as part of our community.
That's right. That's right. And I think the third kind of consequence of this kind of singular way of thinking about diversity is that it supports this idea of reverse discrimination. So there always seemed to be this anxiety, almost this script about affirmative action going too far. So, you know, I interviewed students at Harvard who said things like, if I hadn't gotten into Harvard, I would have felt that I had experienced racial discrimination if the Black kid in my high school had gotten in over me. And the student has gotten into, you know, one of the most, if not the most, you know, coveted universities in the country. But still, this anxiety is there in the back of his mind. And you can imagine, and students talked about applying for summer internships or jobs when they don't get what they aren't as successful as they are getting into Harvard. And then, you know, affirmative action is an easy target to explain why they didn't succeed in any of these competitive processes.
Is there a way we can measure how much affirmative action influences college admissions? Can we give it a percentage?
Yeah, that's a really hard question to answer, in part because the only legally sound way to use affirmative action is through a kind of holistic admissions process, right? And this has been part of multiple decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court, that quotas are not allowed, but you can take race into consideration among many other kinds of pieces of information about student applicants. And the other reason that it's a hard question to answer is because, you know, we have to remember that most colleges are not practicing affirmative action because they're not selecting students. And the ones that are selective to varying degrees. At the most elite places, for example, the percentage of Black and Latino students is certainly less than 20%. Many of them, it's less than 15%. And not all of those students are benefiting from affirmative action either. So it's not playing a massive role in admissions. And I think this is the other thing. You know, I always think for every one student that benefits from affirmative action, there's another 20 who think that they didn't get in because of affirmative action.
Is it fair to say that there is reverse discrimination, that when you let one person in, it's a zero-sum game, somebody else didn't get in?
I don't look at it that way, in the sense that for these most elite places, so I interviewed students at Harvard and Brown, and at these kinds of places, there are so many more qualified students than there are spots. So, you know, in terms of zero sum, yes, they're going to admit a certain number of students. But are there these trade-offs? I think that's the wrong way to think about it. Because, again, you know, there's affirmative action, there's athletic recruiting, there's legacy benefits. There are all these different kinds of things that we might contest. And it's not like you can pick the one that made you not get in.
Is there a strong argument to be made for affirmative action as a form of reparation? Years of absolutely denying African-American and other minority students from entrance to the elite colleges. Now it is owed to this student body as a form of reparations.
Absolutely. I think there's a very strong case to be made. You know, there's very explicit ties in these universities historically to both to slavery, but also to excluding people of color for decades. And, you know, I think it, as a society as well, an American society, I think there's a very strong case to be made for reparations. And universities can be play an important role in those reparations in terms of changing people's life opportunities.
We've been talking primarily about minority groups that are African American or Latino. What about Asian American students? You write that there's a penalty in the college admissions process for Asian American students.
Yeah, Asian American students have an interesting role in these universities because when there's been some research looking at their SAT scores and grade point averages and shows that on average their scores are higher than those of their white peers. Sometimes these studies will control for, were you an athletic recruit? Because the universities will say, well, Asian Americans are less likely to be recruited athletes on these universities. They're also less likely to be legacies. That is, their parents are less likely than white students to have gone to that university. And those are the two disadvantages that they have vis-a-vis white students. I think we need to put these out in the open. I think what's happened most recently is that the anti-affirmative action activists have kind of co-opted this issue in their critique of affirmative action. So they say, so for example, Harvard is being sued right now. There's a lawsuit against affirmative action. And the suit is saying that it discriminates against Asian Americans in admissions. Now, again, this is that zero-sum logic that I think is faulty, which says that, well, if you are admitting students under affirmative action, you're taking away from Asian American students. And of course, that assumes that the space for white students is constant. You know, I also sometimes hear this argument of, well, we don't want too many Asian Americans on our campuses because we need a diverse campus. And to me, this is problematic because white students on the majority of these campuses are still the majority, but we kind of think that that is okay. But a majority Asian campus, for example, people see as problematic in a different kind of way because Asian Americans are otherized and seen as a minority group.
In 2003, in the ruling on affirmative action, Sandra Day O'Connor said that 25 years later, racial preferences wouldn't be needed anymore. Do you think she's right? Are we just 10 years away from that kind of equality?
I wish I could say that I thought that we were. Unfortunately, I don't think that that's the case. I think American society is rife with racial inequality. I think we have a lot of reckoning to do about our racial divides in the United States. You know, it's important to keep in mind that universities are part of a racialized society. And so, you know, I appreciate the sentiment of thinking that, you know, we want to get ourselves to a place in which we have this racial equity, and that means that we don't need to consider race in admissions. It's hard for me to imagine being there in 10 years.
Natasha Waraku is an associate professor of education at Harvard University. Only 8% of Black students opt out of the mainstream college system and attend historically Black colleges and universities. But those who do have a higher chance of graduating, and they often face better prospects after college. Mary Beth Gassman is the director of the Penn Center for Minority-Serving Institutions at the University of Pennsylvania. She says despite the threat of funding cuts, HBCUs still play an important role in American higher education. Mary Beth, what does the historically Black college and university experience give primarily African American students that they might not get elsewhere in another institution?
Attending an HBCU gives students a Black experience, and I can't really stress that enough. You know, one of the things that happens is that they're in an environment that is predominantly Black. Every day they see teachers who are African American or Black and are teaching them. And, you know, most African Americans can go through their entire high school, they can go through college without having a Black teacher. So they're surrounded by Black administrators who are in leadership positions. And I think one of the things that happens that people underestimate is that they don't have to confront and deal with white racism on a daily basis. And so one of the things that can be really it can have an impact on your learning is if you are constantly facing microaggressions, racism on a daily basis. And so HBCUs nurture and uplift African-American students in ways that majority institutions have not yet discovered how to do.
Of course, historically Black colleges and universities once were the only way for African-Americans to earn a college degree and a graduate degree. And for decades during the era of segregation, they were educating the elite, the doctors, the lawyers. But when the white colleges were forced to integrate, many Black students did opt for these other institutions. What did that kind of brain drain in terms of the elite Black students do to these institutions?
Well, so it's interesting because, you know, after 1954, when segregation became illegal, you didn't see an immediate influx of Black students into white institutions because of racism, right? So you don't really see it until about the late 1960s, 70s. Right now, we have 8% of Black students go to historically Black colleges. But if you take a really good look at the production of students by historically Black colleges, one of the things you find is that there's this huge diversity. You know, there are some HBCU students that would attend more of a regional state institution or a community college if they didn't attend an HBCU. There are some students that would attend maybe, you know, a small liberal arts kind of medium selectivity school. There are some that would fit in just fine at maybe a more prestigious state flagship institution. And then there are some that would get into Ivy League institutions or these really highly selective institutions. So you have, it cuts across the whole gamut of students. The other thing I would say about this is that HBCUs, if we didn't have them right now, we would continue to have low numbers of doctors, low numbers of lawyers, low numbers of professors, low numbers of pharmacists, because what they do is they're really, really good at propelling students into graduate and professional programs. If you look at the top 10 across the majority of professional and graduate programs, usually 8 of the schools are HBCUs in terms of their ability to produce and push students into those programs. So we would be at a loss without HBCUs.
Why are they good at this?
What we found overall is that there's a family-like environment where people feel safe, secure, nurtured, believed in. One of the things that I often tell people is that in colleges and universities overall, faculty don't always believe in the success of their students. Sometimes they look at students who might not look like them or might come from a poor background, and they think, well, you know, I'm not sure if they're as smart. I'm not sure if they have the ability. It's not that they're not smart or they don't have the ability. It's that they don't have the opportunity. And what Black colleges do is they believe that everyone should be given the opportunity And that's one of the things they focus on. And then the other thing that they do that I think is really remarkable and that majority institutions could learn from is students are at the center of learning and teaching. That runs contrary to the way that most faculty learn how to teach and work with students. Recently, about a year ago, I decided to change the way I teach based on what I learned as I was writing this book on Black colleges and how they prepare students in STEM. What I realized is when I was in graduate school and as a new professor, I was taught spend the least amount of time with students, you know, design the course so that it advantages you. And what I realized is that if I really care about students, then I need to make sure that they have not only the content knowledge, but that they have all the skills that they need to go out into the world. And that I also need to make the class more student-centered. And so I revised both of my syllabi to focus on students.
What specific teaching changes did you make that, as you put it, were student-friendly?
I teach history of American higher education. And so one of the things that I did is I started to include an assignment where I taught students how to write opinion essays and publish them in national papers. And one of the reasons why I did this is because I focus a lot in the class on the power of your voice and the power of activism and the power you have as a student to make change. And I always spend a lot of time talking about the history of students making incredible change at colleges and universities. This assignment, they loved it. And many of them ended up getting published, and they ended up doing these kinds of things over and over in the future. Another activity I did with them, and you know, most historians would probably just freak out for me saying this, but I had them design a Twitter campaign around a historical issue that had current ramifications. And so what they had to do is they had to do the design work, they had to do Twitter chats, they had to invite experts into the Twitter chats, they had to do all the historical research on an issue and all the current research on an issue, and they did these in teams. Now, you might ask, so why would you do that? Well, I want them to learn about an issue, I want them to connect history to the current day, but I also want them to have a skill. And one of the things I know is that more and more and more in most jobs, if you don't understand how social media works, you're in a lot of trouble. So one of the things I do is I really try to get them to think about all these new technologies and how you can use them in order to get people to understand history. And I learned a lot of these things from sitting in classes at historically Black colleges and watching faculty in the sciences do these incredibly innovative things with students. You know, one thing that I love is that at Black colleges, they have a lot of peer-to-peer support. So they don't necessarily just think that the professor is all-knowing. And so that's another thing that I started doing is really getting my students to, instead of compete with each other, to collaborate and see that their success is intertwined. That's something I learned from Black colleges.
What percentage of these Black colleges, historically Black colleges, are publicly funded?
About 70% of them are funded through the state, and all Black colleges receive federal funding.
And how do they get their federal funding?
They get federal funding through the Higher Education Act. And part of the reason for that is that the federal funding is based on past discrimination that they experienced in funding streams.
Are they adequately funded?
No, they are not adequately funded at all. We've done reports in recent years across a whole variety of states, and one of the things that we found is that in some states, historically Black colleges, if you look at the per student funding by the state, if you're at a majority institution, you're funded at 50% more than you are at a historically Black college.
How can that be at an equitable public funding level?
Because what people will say to you is, well, we can do that because these majority institutions are more important. And what they're saying is that the students at those institutions are more important. I mean, this happens across almost all of the southern states, and there's no apology about it. In fact, I have been on panels where I've been there with someone who is in the state system from the budget office. And one time I was on this panel, and one of the budget people said to me, if you think the inequity per student is a big deal, you should look at the difference in faculty salary. Then you'll really be shocked. And of course, I had already looked at that, and I knew that the faculty were paid minuscule salaries compared to the majority institutions. So if we really, really valued historically Black colleges, we would realize that they had endured decades upon decades upon decades of inequity in funding, and we would do something to remedy that. So we would invest in their fundraising infrastructure so that they would be able to bring in funds like most majority institutions do. We would invest in more student success programs so that we could increase student retention. We would invest in the infrastructure of the campuses. I mean, one of the things that you immediately notice is if you go to a public HBCU and you go to a public majority white institution, the majority white institution typically has beautiful buildings, beautiful grounds, lots of lushness on the campus, lots of services. And then the historically Black college has about a fourth of that. And these inequities, They're everywhere. One of the best ones I've ever seen is if you go to the University of South Carolina and then you go to South Carolina State, it's as if you are in two different countries. It's inequitable even in states that don't have Black colleges. So, you know, you will see certain institutions privileged and others institutions not privileged. But once you have Black colleges, what you see is an overwhelming privileging of the majority institutions and an underprivileging of the Black colleges. I mean, North Carolina is probably one of the very best examples of this. And to be quite frank, if we did not have the Black colleges in North Carolina, we'd hardly have any Black male students in college because the majority of them are going to Black colleges. What's interesting about that is these public Black colleges were set up specifically because majority public institutions wanted federal funds for higher education, but did not want to educate African Americans in the same schools as whites. And so sometimes people will say to me, well, why don't Blacks just all go to majority institutions? Well, you know, majority institutions were also segregated institutions. They were also, you know, just like Black colleges were almost all Black, white institutions were all white. And so why can't you put money into some of these Black colleges and let white students go to them? I mean, if we think about that, it'll kind of blow your mind after a while. It's the way that we think. We tend to think things that are Black are not as good, and we continue to think that. That's how American racism works.
Mary Beth Gassman is director of the Penn Center for Minority Serving Institutions at the University of Pennsylvania. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back.
Start your exciting career as a surgical technologist now. Henry Ford College has a 2-year program with a 98% employment rate. Job offers are up by 24% all over the United States. You'll graduate with an associate degree and hands-on surgical experience. Prepare for fall 2018 enrollment and call a health career advisor today at 313-317-6845.
As an 18-year-old, I let my mistakes kind of take over my life. I was 0.5 credits away from completing high school, and I didn't do it.
10 years later, at age 28, Jackie finished her high school diploma.
When I found out that I was pregnant, I know that I had to do something for myself if I wanted to make her a better person and provide a better life for her. My family never stopped pushing for me to be better because they knew what I could become and who I could become as a person. My support team is amazing. The educational director, my sister, and even my 7-year-old daughter has just been more than the support that I could ask for. I've been given an opportunity, and I'm just thankful for it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell. In 2012, total student debt in America surpassed $1 trillion. Students took to the streets in protest. Five years later, the average student debt load continues to rise. It's now $37,000. But the pain of student debt is not felt equally. My next guest is Jason Houle, an assistant professor of sociology at Dartmouth College. He says our conversation about student debt has a long way to go.
What we kind of hear is these two competing camps. And on the one hand, you have the folks who say, you know, student loan debt is a great investment. We shouldn't be worried about it. This is not a crisis. Everything is fine. Nothing to see here. On the other hand, you have folks who are like, you know, student loan debt is a crisis. The sky is falling and, you know, we're all going to die, right? So there's a lot of hyperbole kind of on both sides. And I would say that my work kind of lands squarely in the middle of that, where what we find is that Yes, students of color, students from socially disadvantaged, economically and socially disadvantaged backgrounds tend to borrow quite a bit more than their counterparts. You find that these groups are also repaying their loans at much slower rates.
What portion of college students take on debt to help pay for their schooling? Is it almost everybody?
It's a large percent and a growing percent, but even 10 years ago, 2006, 2007, it was really only about 40 to 50% of college students, and now it's probably closer to 70 or 80%.
What changed? I remember when I was going to school, there were people who had to work off their payments, but there wasn't so much talk about massive debt upon graduation.
Well, I think one of the big things that's changed is our model for higher education has changed dramatically over the past several decades. You know, we've seen basically costs of higher education in terms of tuition and beyond tuition in terms of things like room and board and cost of living creep up and up and up, while at the same time, state and local appropriations and also federal aid has kind of stagnated. And it's basically families and, you know, the students who are going to school who are kind of left to foot the bill.
Even at the state-supported schools, tuition is so high, many are taking on debt?
Average debt tends to be higher at private institutions, but even at four-year publics, you're seeing a substantial amount of debt being taken out.
Is this a good investment for students? Does it pay off?
You know, that's a tough question because for a lot of folks, this debt and this investment will pay off, but for others, it won't.
So who is most burdened by student debt in your studies? Are there groups that are having a harder time than others?
Yeah, what we're finding in our work is that students of color, particularly black students, and students from more socially and economically disadvantaged backgrounds are the ones who are kind of struggling with the highest debt burdens and also struggling more to pay those debts off. So if you are from a household where neither of your parents have a college degree, you're the first one to kind of step foot on a college campus in your family, you end up with a lot more debt. And part of that is because, yeah, your parents can't help you pay this down, but also a lot of it is about cultural capital or cultural familiarity. So if you come from a college-educated background, your parents know how to kind of help you navigate that college you're going to, both financially and otherwise, maybe help you find scholarships or kind of help you navigate the institutions, the pitfalls. First-generation college students just don't have that.
Is there also a difference in what repayment looks like for some kids versus others? What did you find?
There is a difference. So for starters, we know from the college scorecard data that only 47% of young people who are not in default, who are in repayment, have made progress on their debt. That means they've paid a dollar or more towards their principal. So that right there, when folks say, you know, student loan debt isn't a problem, we shouldn't worry about it. Well, when only half of borrowers who aren't in default, this is totally getting rid of folks who are in default, which is another question entirely. But when half of borrowers are not really making any progress 5 years out, that raises a lot of questions. And so this led my colleague Feniba Addo and I at University of Wisconsin-Madison to basically ask, what do these repayments look like by race? And what we're finding is that racial disparities or racial differences in debt when people leave college are big, they're large, we kind of knew that, but they get much, much bigger as people age. And so the racial disparity in debt we find at least doubles, if not triples, by the time young people hit their 30s.
And what does that mean to you as far as lives?
We think of college or getting a college degree as sort of this engine of upward mobility, and that it can sort of solve a lot of our deep social inequities and inequalities. And what this shows is that the payoffs to a college degree are so starkly different. And in an era where college costs are high and debt is high, that Black students are paying a higher cost of entry for their college degree. And this is something that my colleague Louise Seamster has called predatory inclusion. That is, students of color have historically been barred from entering post-secondary institutions. Now that they have access on unequal terms.
It's sad to me because you think we spend a lifetime with these young students telling them college is everything. Make sure you get to college. Make sure you go through it. And when they get there and find out they've got to take on a lot of debt, they just do, because that's the formula.
So I would add one more thing about the race difference, and in terms of one more reason why we should be concerned about it. So sociologists have long talked about the fragility of middle class status for Blacks. It is much harder for Black families to make it to the middle class, and once Black families get there, it's so much easier for them to fall out. And this idea that these high levels of student loan debt among what is ostensibly the next generation of the Black middle class might be what makes this group fragile as well, just like their parents.
If we could wave our wand and change the debt crisis in some way, do you have one or two recommendations on how we might restructure things politically?
This is a great question. So the way I like to think about these interventions is, is this an upstream solution or is it a downstream solution? That is, are we pulling drowning people out of the water, or are we going upstream and preventing people from falling into the river in the first place? And so I think we probably need a little bit of both here. You know, some of my colleagues are very much in favor of upstream solutions, and that is reinvestment in higher education. That's the free college movement, which has sort of become the moniker for progressives in the past several years. But I also think there's some very simple things to do. So one thing that does seem to be less successful than it should be is income-based repayment, this idea that your student loan payments are tied to however much you make. And it turns out that enrollment in IBR programs are really shockingly low. And so if we try to think like behavioral economists in terms of nudges, maybe instead of making income-based repayments opt-in, where you have to go and sign up for them, we make them opt-out. And that is for the most vulnerable borrowers. That is the default setting, is income-based repayment.
What about colleges bringing down the cost of attendance?
Colleges bringing down the cost of attendance, I mean, it's a great idea in theory. The question is, how do you do that? So, I mean, one reason the costs of attendance have gone up so much, particularly at state institutions, is that state appropriations to colleges have fallen dramatically. So if you take major flagship universities, places like the University of Wisconsin-Madison or Penn State or perhaps UNC Chapel Hill, a lot of these places get less than 20% of their budget from the state government. These are sort of state institutions by name only. And what happens is when this occurs is these colleges become more tuition driven. Schools have, I would say, responded to the climate in which they're in. And if we could wave a magic wand and reduce prices, that would be great. But then we would have a lot of schools operating in the red. But the focus on tuition kind of misses the boat on the student loan debt crisis. Student loan debt, really very little of it is about tuition. So take Sweden for an example. Sweden has free college, free tuition, and yet they have debt levels that are comparable to the United States. A lot of it is about, I can't really work and effectively study and get out of college in time. I need to rent a place. I need a place to lay my head, and I need to eat. And so a lot of the student loan debt crisis is driven by living expenses, not necessarily tuition.
How much of a factor do you think is the income cutoff for aid? So many hopeful parents reach the stage where they're about to send their children off to a pricey institution, fill out the FAFSA forms, only to be told, nothing.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. So that's something that my friends in the financial aid world refer to as the expected family contribution. And for a lot of folks, the expected family contribution doesn't really take into account the family's expenses. You know, when we think about the middle class wages have stagnated over the past 30 years, and we're asking them to contribute more and more for, in this case, their kids' education. For a lot of people, the expected financial contribution just certainly isn't realistic. And in fact, I can say that I found that in my previous research. So if we look at the relationship between how much money your parents make and how much debt you end up with, actually where we find the highest debt loads are students who are kind of just beyond that financial aid cutoff. So most need-based aid, I'd say 90% of it, goes to families who make less than $40,000 a year. Where we find the highest debt, in some ways not surprisingly, is those families who are just above those cutoffs. So coming from families who make $40,000 to maybe $55,000 a year. Those are the families with the most debt.
What do you say to people who say, well, when I was coming through college, I simply buckled down, got as many extra side jobs as I needed, and I worked my way through?
That's a great question. You know, there's so many think pieces out there about how financially irresponsible millennials are, right? You know, it's always the case where the generations before like to disparage the generation after. And perhaps, you know, sort of my favorite foil when it comes to this is Congresswoman Virginia Fox, who espouses this exact same idea, where she's basically been on the record as saying, you know what? Student loan debtors, I have no sympathy for them at all, because they're basically a bunch of irresponsible misanthropes. I went to UNC Chapel Hill. I waited tables. I worked. And maybe it took me 5-6 years to graduate, but I left debt-free. And that's fine. But the problem is that Virginia Fox's experiences in no way match up with the experiences of average students today. So let's say, you know, Virginia Fox went to UNC Chapel Hill. She was an in-state resident, and she went there in 1968, right? So in today's dollars, tuition was around $2,000. Maybe room and board was around $5,300. So maybe she'd be on the hook for $7,000, $7,400 a year, roughly. And, you know, at the minimum wage at the time, it would only take her 20 hours a week to pay that off, bussing tables, which is exactly what she said. But in 2013, tuition at UNC Chapel Hill was $8,300. Room and board and costs were $15,000, almost $16,000. And so you're on the hook for around $24,000 a year, which under today's minimum wage, you would have to work 88 hours a week in order to pay off. And so Virginia Fox might be able to say, you know, look, I did it, so can you. But the reality is, no, they can't.
Jason Houle is an assistant professor of sociology at Dartmouth College. If you watch television in the 90s, you've probably heard of ITT Tech.
You can't get the jobs of tomorrow until you get the skills of today. Start by calling ITT Technical Institute. We'll send you an informative brochure on tomorrow's careers.
ITT Tech has since folded, but a new crop of for-profit colleges is expanding to fill the void.
At Kaplan University, we can help prepare you for that career you always dreamed about.
Discover Capella University's FlexPath.
At DeVry University, we believe there are also lots of reasons to finish.
You're ready for Strayer University.
But as for-profit colleges have grown in number, so have their critics. My next guest is Stephanie Cellini, an associate professor of public policy at George Washington University. She says for-profit colleges are often promising something they can't deliver.
There's more than 2,000 or so of these for-profit colleges that receive federal student aid, and there's many more thousands of these schools that don't receive federal student aid. They range from very large schools like the University of Phoenix, which I believe is the largest institution of higher education in the country, to very small schools that are focused on one particular vocation. So, for example, cosmetology schools are often for-profit.
How long have they been around, for the most part? And haven't they been experiencing sort of boom and bust years, depending on the decade?
Yeah, that's right. They've been around for a really long time. Over 100 years they've been around. And they do seem to go through these cycles around when the GI Bill was introduced. There was some growth in the industry and then a kind of crackdown in the 1950s. And then we saw this again. We saw growth in the 1970s with the expansion of federal student aid programs. And then another kind of crackdown again. And again, we saw this in the 1990s. And we saw under Bush Sr. some new, what they call cohort default rate regulations. And those regulations led to the sanctioning of over 1,000 for-profit colleges in the 1990s. So we saw them kind of ebb in the 1990s and then kind of grow again in the early 2000s.
In the early 2000s, boy, did they grow. What was primarily responsible for that? Do you have numbers on how big they got?
Yeah, well, they enrolled at their peak over 2 million students, and that accounted for about 12% of all higher education enrollment. They're now down to about 1.8 million in my latest count, students. And really, the numbers, just from 2000 to 2010, the number of students close to quadrupled.
Who are their biggest competitors? Who are they siphoning students away from?
So I think the kind of closest competitors and biggest competitors are the public community colleges. Most of the certificates and degrees that for-profit colleges grant are at the kind of sub-baccalaureate level, so associate's degrees and certificates. So we're really thinking about those students as being able to choose potentially between community colleges and for-profit colleges. But it's also been interesting in the last few years, there's been a lot of growth in bachelor's degrees being offered by for-profit colleges as well. So there's still a fairly small share of overall for-profit enrollment. I think less than 20% is in these bachelor's degree programs and master's degree programs, but they are growing at this kind of higher level of education now.
Which charge more tuition, the community colleges or the for-profits?
Oh, the for-profits charge much more tuition. In fact, it's about five times higher in a for-profit college than in a community college. So I think the average in a for-profit for a year of your certificate program is about $15,000. And I think that compares to about nationwide in community colleges, about $3,000, $3,500, something like that.
Why do you think students, especially when so many of them really don't have means, are choosing the higher tuition for-profit schools?
That's a great question, and one that I've been trying to answer for a long time. My go-to answer here is that I think that students are taken in by advertising sometimes and may not have a lot of information about all their different college options. So for example, it may be that some students who might be first-generation college students don't have the information they need or access to networks that would help them choose or think about their options in terms of the public community college down the street that might offer the same program for a quarter the price. And they might see a nice advertisement on TV and call the 1-800 number and get talked into a for-profit college without having that kind of full information. And we were particularly concerned about this because a lot of the students in for-profit colleges, they enroll a disproportionate share of minority students, students from lower income backgrounds, students who are single parents and may not have the time to investigate their college options, students who are working and older and returning to college after many years in the workplace who don't have access to high school counselors, for example.
So how should students look at the return on their investment? If you're a student who does not have means and you're thinking about a for-profit and a community college, what are some of the metrics that you have researched that helps a student know how to make a choice?
Yeah, so I think something that's very important to think about is the bump in earnings you get from kind of before to after. Are you getting that kind of increase that you might expect from going to college? And is that enough to kind of cover the debt that you're going to incur? So to do this, I've been doing some research with data from the U.S. Treasury using tax returns as well as the Department of Ed. And we have a very large sample of students who were graduating right around the recession. And we looked at this kind of after minus before earnings gain, this kind of value added of the education. And we compared for-profit students in certificate programs to public students in community colleges in similar certificate programs. Certificates in vehicles maintenance, in cosmetology, in health assisting, in health administration, those types of fields.
Right.
You might think about a public sector student in the local community college who's a woman in her 30s in Washington, D.C., in a health assistant program, matched with a student in a for-profit college, also in Washington, D.C., also in her 30s, also in a health assistant program, but in a for-profit. So in the public sector, those students who got these certificates, their earnings went up by about $1,500. And then for-profit students, their earnings were actually going down by about $920. And so this kind of difference between the two, which is what we were really interested in, the difference between them was this gap of about, you know, $2,500 or so.
So your research is showing for-profit colleges are costing more and giving less?
That's exactly right. For-profit colleges are definitely costing a lot more for students, and they are giving them less. Their earnings gains are a lot lower than going to a public institution. And then we can also take into account the fact that 75% or so of for-profit students are actually borrowing, compared to just 20% of community college students. And they're paying a lot more. So I think the average debt for a for-profit student is about $6,000, and the average debt of a community college student is about $900.
What about the experience of dropouts for community college and for for-profit colleges? Are they comparable?
Yeah, this is a very interesting case. So in our research, the dropouts in our study from for-profit colleges do quite a bit worse. They have very large declines in earnings relative to before. And in contrast, the dropouts from public community colleges actually see a small increase in their earnings. So it seems as though that taking a few classes at a community college might boost your earnings and help you get a job and kind of be a signal to an employer that you took a good quality course at a local public institution that has a good reputation. And what I am concerned about is in the for-profits, it seems that if you take a couple courses in that for-profit, it could almost be a negative signal of quality that you started at a for-profit and you weren't able to complete.
Is there any understanding of why for-profit universities target the poorest students for recruitment, even though they have the higher tuition rates? This just seems counterintuitive.
Yeah, it does seem counterintuitive, but maybe not when you think about the role of federal student aid. So federal student aid allows students to get a Pell Grant, for example, for about close to $6,000 to pay for their education, and then they can borrow.
And what percent of their revenue at the for-profit colleges is coming from government aid from these students?
On average, about 70% of the revenue that for-profit colleges get comes from federal student aid programs. And that is counting only the Pell Grant and student loan programs and not counting money coming from the GI Bill and other programs that are targeted towards military students and veterans. So in fact, they may be getting even more of their revenue from federal government sources than just that 70% that I mentioned there. So I think federal student aid is really important to get students access to college. But what I worry about is that some of the colleges, and the for-profit colleges in particular, have not really shown that they can kind of make that earnings gain happen. They haven't really shown that value. So I think we need to be very careful about making sure that these institutions really prove their worth before they're able to give out federal student aid.
Is there a role for for-profit colleges, in your opinion?
I think there is a role for for-profit colleges. I think filling some of the gaps, particularly if community colleges have, you know, wait lists for their nursing program or something like that, I think there might be a role for for-profits to step in and help ease those constraints and give students some of the training they need. But I do think we need to look carefully at the for-profit sector because I think the incentives of the institutions are slightly different. I think the profit incentive and knowing that the profits do not need to be reinvested into the institution, but they can be given out to shareholders, I think it's a different mission. And I think it creates different incentives for the institution that I do think we need to be concerned about.
That is fascinating. Stephanie Cellini, thank you for sharing your insights on With Good Reason.
Thanks for having me.
Stephanie Cellini is an associate professor of economics, public policy, and public administration at George Washington University. In our next episode, we're changing our perspective, stepping away from students and toward the people who teach them. Many states in America are experiencing devastating teacher shortages and budget cuts that threaten the future of the profession. We'll talk to a teacher of the year who couldn't support his family on estate pay and ask how we can get good teachers to where they're needed most. This program was funded by a grant to Dr. Oliver Hill at Virginia State University by the National Science Foundation. Major support for With Good Reason is provided by the Shia Khan Foundation and by the law firm of McGuire Woods. Support also comes from the University of Virginia Health System, pioneering treatments to save lives and preserve brain function for stroke patients. UVAHealth.com. With Good Reason is produced by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Elliot Majerzik, Allison Quantz, Lilia Fukin, and John Last are our associate producers. Jeannie Palin handles listener services, and our interns are Victoria Joyner, Peter Eckel, and Dare Nguyen. For the podcast, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
Henry Ford College provides a strong foundation for students pursuing a career in education, offering a two-year associate's degree in pre-education as well as pre-secondary and special education. For more information about HFC's pre-education degrees, please call 313-845-6430 or check out the pre-education program guide at hfcc.edu/programs.
Join WHFR this weekend as we broadcast from the 26th Annual Concert of Colors. Concert of Colors is a festival showcasing world music, and WHFR will be down there at the Max M. and Marjorie S. Fisher Music Center on Woodward to help support the great music. WHFR will be right outside the Comerica Diversity Stage and broadcasting from the Cube July 14th and 15th, so stop by and see some of your favorite WHFR DJs. We can tell you where to find everything at Concert of Colors and hear what is coming up on your favorite listener-supported non-commercial radio.
Camp Henry offers hands-on learning activities in science, technology, engineering, arts, and math to help kids and teens with an early start in these high-demand career paths. The Henry Ford College Telecommunication Program and WHFR will show campers how their favorite actors, cartoon voices, newscasters, and DJs work their magic to bring us the entertainment we love. Registration is now open for the media camp, which runs from July 23rd through the 26th, so go to hscc.edu and click on Camp Henry for more details and for more information about the exciting programs Camp Henry has to offer.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
Kitty Love.